When our life is spinning out of control, it's natural to assume we're outside of God's will. After all, if we walked in step with His sovereign plan, we'd be spared from complicated problems, right? Well, today on Insight for Living, Chuck Swindoll reminds us that sometimes the plan of God includes disruption, even suffering. Chuck is teaching from Exodus chapters 5 and 6. In this passage, we read about a season of grief that seemed to be a result of following God's will. From his biographical series on Moses, Chuck titled today's message, Going from Bad to Worse.
Ever had one of those days that started bad and got worse as the day went on? Yeah? Some of you are saying, oh, if you had a month, I could tell you about one day last week. Mrs. Monroe of Darlington, Maryland has a story to tell about a life like that. In fact, a day like that. John Haggai, in his fine book, How to Win Over Worry, tells the story, and it's true. Ms. Monroe has 8 children. That's bad enough to start with, but that's not the story. She came home one day with an armload full of groceries, and she bumped the front door open, and before she set the groceries down, she saw 5 of her little darlings sitting right in the middle of the living room floor, intensely interested in something. They were, as every parent could understand, unusually quiet, sitting in that little circle. And so she set the groceries down, and she leaned over, and she saw 5 of the cutest little skunks you could imagine right in that circle. And they were playing with them. And she said to the children, "Children, run!" And each kid grabbed a skunk and ran. She was frantic. She was frantic. And she carried on in such a way that she scared each child so much, he squeezed his skunk. Oh, man. Yeah, as Haggai says, and skunks don't like to be squaws. You feel sort of like the fighter who, after getting the pulp beat out of him, said he should have stood in bed that day. You know, he should have stayed home altogether. Or like the sign I saw in an office, the faster I go, the behinder I get. You've had a day like that lately, maybe. It helps a little bit to know you're not alone. It really does. As a matter of fact, a man as mighty and as impressive as Moses had a day like that. Our feeling about Moses is that he is some sort of stone saint, sort of a marble statue. Our concept, thanks to Michelangelo and other great men, has twisted our minds. I want you to know that he is merely a man, just like you and me, with drives and impulses and feelings and highs and lows, just like us. A lady who's been listening to the tapes lately in an area where they don't have a church, or apparently she's not able to find something better to do, so she's listening to the tapes, and she's began to listen to those on Moses. She took the time to write me a nice note, and I've lifted a line from the note she sent because it is so typical. She says, "You know, I'm beginning to know Moses so well, he no longer looks like Charlton Heston." Oh, that's good. That's good. Moses doesn't look like Charlton Heston. Cecil B. DeMille did not call the shots in Moses' life. He did not design that man. And I have a feeling that Moses is so far removed from the concept of Charlton Heston that we cannot even draw any similarity between the two. He was a man's man, but he had weaknesses. And we're going to look at one of those days that he probably wished could have been erased from his memory. One of the days like Ms. Monroe experienced, a day like you've had lately, where looking back, you sort of wish somehow it could be erased. And I hope in the process of this analysis, you'll find some encouragement. Turn to Exodus chapter 5, And we're going to look at two chapters, 5 and 6, in the book of Exodus. And I hope that we get from these two chapters a realistic appraisal of a man who was real, but a man who had a hard day when things went from bad to worse. Now, woven into the fabric of these two chapters are three major personalities. There is Pharaoh, there is Moses, and of course there is Jehovah himself. All three are seen in these two chapters. The predominant personality, of course, is the Lord. The predominant human personality is Moses. But the catalyst in the midst of these two chapters is Pharaoh. He is the reason things got bent out of shape for Moses. I find in the 5th chapter especially a cycle of events that repeats itself several times. There is an announcement followed by a reaction leading to anger, resulting in blame, followed by an announcement leading to a reaction that turns to anger and results in blame, followed by an announcement. In other words, it is flowing all the way through the chapter. Now, the announcement to begin with is found in verse 1. Remember now, Moses and Aaron are off a spiritual high. They have just had a tremendous Bible conference with the people of Israel. And they have assembled together according to the last 3 verses of chapter 4. And the people have said, "We believe in you, Moses. We'll stand behind you. We're trusting God to work through your leadership to get us out of the land of Egypt." Now, of course, they had one mindset and God had another. God had told Moses it wouldn't be without its difficulties. But you know how we are. We don't want to think about that part of the plan. We just want to think about deliverance. And so fresh off that marvelous experience of loyalty and devotion, that crest of emotion, Moses and Aaron, chapter 5, verse 1, appear before the God of the land, Pharaoh. "Afterward, Moses and Aaron came and said to Pharaoh, 'Thus says Jehovah, the God of Israel, let my people go, that they may celebrate a feast to me in the wilderness.'" Now that's a good, direct mandate. It wasn't a request. It was a declaration. It was a command. "Pharaoh, let the Hebrews go." Now you've got to appreciate, even though you cannot possibly enter into it, nor can I, the impact of a man like Pharaoh. He was the God of Egypt. He was worshipped. There were built in his honor the Sphinx. There were exalted in the land gods that carried his name. What he said occurred. And through the movement of magic and the incredible demonic powers that he carried with him, he was an impressive personality, as were all of those in the line of Pharaoh. Moses and Aaron, fresh off the desert experience, stood before the majesty of the land, and they commanded him to let the Hebrews go. I'm sure in Moses' mind, he thought, now it's going to happen. Oh, but it didn't. Look at Pharaoh's response. "Who is the Lord? Who is this Jehovah that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? I don't know Jehovah. And besides, I will not let Israel go." Well, that's bad news, isn't it? Here's Moses expecting a response, a positive agreement, and Pharaoh says, "No way." Ever had your hopes built up and you planned your wording just right? You planned your timing just so it falls together in just the right way, and then that moment comes and you express it, and the person hears it and says, "No way, I am not interested." That's discouraging, isn't it? Well, Moses tightened a notch in his belt and he came back to Pharaoh with a pleading remark. "Please, verse 3, please let us go a 3-day journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or with a sword. Hey, Pharaoh, if you won't let us all go, give us a 3 days journey so we can get our heads together around the Lord and worship him. Give us at least a time of retreat. If you won't release us, let us get away for a few days. You see, that's exactly what God had told Moses to say. Let me show you this. Chapter 3, verse 18. Now, he's doing exactly what the Lord told him to say. Verse 18, and they will pay heed to what you say, meaning the Hebrews. They have. And you with the elders of Israel will come to the king of Egypt, and you will say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. So now, please let us go a 3 days journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. Go back to chapter 5, verse 3. That's exactly what he said. He was God's man with God's message in God's time pleading before Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said, no. Look at verse 4. The king of Egypt said to them, Moses and Aaron, why do you draw the people away from their work? Get back to your labors. Sounds like your boss, doesn't it? Oh, this religious stuff. Look, do your job. Get back to work. Now, notice after that reaction in anger, here's the cycle. It's starting. Pharaoh said, look, the people of the land are now many, and you would have them cease from their labors. The same day, verse 6, don't miss that, the very day, the day that Moses had wished he had never been born, the same day Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters over the people and their foremen. By the way, the taskmasters were Egyptians. The foremen were the Hebrews. The taskmasters were the superintendents of the work who served on the force of the Egyptians. The foremen were people who were pulled and out of the Hebrew ranks, and they served as leaders over the people. So Pharaoh called before them both groups. He said, verse 7, you're no longer to give the people straw to make brick as previously. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. But the quota of bricks which they were making previously, you shall impose on them. You are not to reduce any of it because they are lazy. Therefore, they cry out, let us go and sacrifice to our God. Look, that's a cop-out. Don't listen to them. In fact, you increase the labor. Don't you haul the straw in and dump it on their backyard so they'll have it available. You make them find their own straw. But we're not going to reduce the quota for the bricks. Man, that's a hard word. Verse 9, let the labor be heavier on the men and let them work at it that they may pay no attention to false words. They're dreamers. They've got this Moses and Aaron walking around talking about some deliverance. No way. You make that work harder. And so they did. Boy, that was a task. Verse 10. Taskmasters of the people and their foremen went out and spoke to the people. Now here are the workmen standing there, you know, ankle deep in the mortar, pressing it out, walking it out, preparing the bricks. And look at what they had to say to the people. Thus says Pharaoh, I'm not going to give you any straw. You go and get straw for yourselves wherever you can find it, but none of your labor will be reduced. The people scattered through all the land of Egypt to gather stubble for straw. And the taskmasters pressed them, saying, complete your work quota, your daily amount, just as when you had straw. Now, you know what? They weren't able to do it. They weren't able to make as many bricks. Obviously, they couldn't. They were now looking for straw and bringing it back and working it into the mortar and making those bricks, but they couldn't make as many. And as a result, they were beaten. Verse 14, the foremen of the sons of Israel, whom Pharaoh's taskmasters had set over them, were beaten. They were asked, why have you not completed your required amount, either yesterday or today, in making brick as previously? Then the foremen of the sons of Israel came and cried out to Pharaoh. The cycle starts over. They were given the announcement out of anger, and blame and bitterness, they were told what to do, and they couldn't do it. So they came as if in a union, pleading their cause before the administration. So they stood before Pharaoh, said, "We can't do it." Look at how they worded it. 15. "Why do you deal this way with your servants? There's no straw. Yet they keep saying to us, 'Make bricks.' Behold, your servants are being beaten, but it's the fault of your own people." You see, these men didn't know why they had no straw. They hadn't put it together yet until Pharaoh told them why. He said, verse 17, "You're lazy, very lazy. That's why you said, 'Let us go and sacrifice to Jehovah.'" Seems to be with a curled lip of defiance. He says this to them, and now they put it together in their mind. Ah, it's Moses. It's Aaron. It's because they went to Pharaoh, and out of a spinoff of that reaction is this problem we're facing. So what did they do? Verse 20. "When they left Pharaoh's presence, they met Moses and Aaron as they were waiting for them." Look at that. Boy, they were ready. "And they said to them," look now, "May the Lord look upon you and judge you, for you have made us odious in Pharaoh's sight and in the sight of his servants to put a sword in his hand to kill us." Ah, oh, man, that's pain. Here's Moses. He took God at his word. He stood before Pharaoh and he said almost word perfect what God had told him to say. He said it in the right way. He said it in faith. And Pharaoh said, "No." And as a result, the people were beaten. And a byproduct of that is a group of people that stood before Moses and said, "May God judge you. You know, we were bad enough until you came, but now it's worse." You know, one of the greatest problems that the Christian must endure is the problem of being misunderstood. That's where some of you are tonight. You have done the right thing the right way, but someone has misjudged you and read into your act something that is not true, and you're living under the blow of that. There's not a leader in this world that leads very long without having to stand alone. And there is created for him what one writer calls those hours of lonely anguish. Some of you parents are there tonight. Some of you that work for a boss have been misunderstood, and you've had those lonely hours of anguish. Some of you mates are living with that with your mate. J. Oswald Sanders writes in his book, Spiritual Leadership, these words: "The leader must be one who, while welcoming the friendship and support of all who can offer it, has sufficient inner resources to stand alone, even in the face of fierce opposition." Listen to that. A real leader is one who is able to stand alone even in the face of fierce opposition. In the discharge of his responsibilities, he or she must be prepared to have no one but God. That's all Moses had. And so Moses turned. Suddenly the text changes here. Here we have these people attacking Moses, and as a result, Moses has no one to turn to. He hasn't his wife. He hasn't a close personal friend that can meet his needs. And so he has no one else to turn to, but who? The Lord. So what does he do? Verse 22, I love the way it begins. Moses returned to the Lord. And he says, "Oh Lord, why hast thou brought harm to this people? Why didst thou ever send me?" Sound familiar? "I told you back at the bush that I'm not the guy for the job. And you kept saying, 'Moses, you're the man.' And I kept saying, 'No, I'm not.' You kept saying, 'Yes, you are.' I finally gave in. And here I am, Lord." And they're saying, "No. You see, I told you, I'm not the fellow for the job." Yet Will the real God of Egypt or Israel please stand up? It's the way he feels. Pharaoh's calling the shots. Look, I did exactly what you wanted me to do in your way with your words. And Pharaoh's kicking sand in my face. And I don't have any answer. As a matter of fact, I feel guilty because so many people are being beaten as a result of my attempts to do what is right. Well, Moses, when he comes before the Lord, asks those two questions that inevitably we ask when we're under pressure. Tension always causes us, well, almost always causes us to say, why? And then, how? The first question we ask is why? Why this? Why me? Why now? And then the next question we ask is, how in the world am I going to get out of this? Some of you are nodding with your eyeballs as you look at me, saying, you have indeed been looking in my window. That's where I've been. I have been saying to the Lord for the last several days, why? How? Well, look at what God says back to Moses. Well, chapter 6, verse 1, the Lord said to Moses, you ought to be ashamed of yourself. No, he doesn't say that. Some of you are looking through your, where does that say you ought to be ashamed of yourself? Where? That's not there. No, he never says that to his children. God doesn't backhand you across the cheek, even when you come and say why. The Lord said to Moses, now you shall see what I will do to Pharaoh. I love that. Let me tell you, Moses, I'm the God. I'm calling the shots. Maybe for a brief period, you think he's in charge. Don't kid yourself, Moses. I'm Jehovah. Under compulsion, he shall let them go, and under compulsion, he shall drive them out of his land. Look at that. Moses, that's my promise. I promise you, this will happen.
Chuck Swindoll has just begun his study in Exodus chapters 5 and 6. He titled today's message, Going from Bad to Worse. Stay with us because we've set aside the closing moments of today's program to hear an encouraging word from Chuck. But first, as you're ready to discover more timeless wisdom from the life of Moses, we invite you to dig into the book of Exodus on your own. It's filled with fascinating stories of conflict and resolution, and each one tells us more about the character and faithfulness of God. To spark your imagination and help you dig deeper on your own, Chuck asked his creative team to help him produce what we call our Searching the Scriptures Bible Studies. It's a workbook or journal that's spiral-bound and lays flat on your table or lap. In this Bible study workbook for Moses, you're guided through the same method that Chuck uses for studying the Bible. We'd love to send you the Searching the Scriptures Bible Study Workbook today. To purchase a copy for our study on Moses, go to insight.org/workbooks or call us at 800-772-8888. You know, from time to time, we receive questions from listeners who want to know why Chuck continues to keep such a busy schedule. Well, the fact is, Chuck remains committed to his public ministry pursuits because he believes that God's Word contains hopeful answers in a season of complicated issues.
By now, all of you know that I'm not predisposed to a doom and gloom outlook on life. God just didn't wire me that way. But without question, I've never witnessed the level of cultural chaos confronting all of us today. The forces of evil are dramatically at work, working overtime to create confusion, distraction, and fear. Frankly, the escalation of these battles has ignited a greater personal passion to preach and to teach the truth while there's still time. At Insight for Living, we're not winding down. In fact, we're ramping up. We're completing one of the most productive years in the history of Insight for Living, and we're positioned to accomplish even more in this new year that's ahead. As we approach December 31st, I'm calling on you to personally invest your resources in Insight for Living. so that people will hear the clear and calming message that God is still very much in control. Remember, your gift today not only brings insight to you, but your year-end gift delivers insight to others. You see, it's your partnership that determines what we can accomplish together. So let's band together as a family to make sure the truth of God's Word breaks through the noise so that people far and near can benefit from Insight for Living. To express my thanks for your year-end donation, we'll be sending you my latest book called Finding God When the World's on Fire. And I look forward to hearing from you today.
Thanks, Chuck. And here's how to respond. First, to speak with one of our friendly ministry reps, you can call us at 800-772-8888. Or you can give a gift online at insight.org. If you'd like to send your year-end donation in the mail, here's our address. It's Insight for Living, Post Office Box 5000, Frisco, Texas, 75034. Thanks so much for doing your part by giving a generous year-end donation to Insight for Living Ministries. Again, you can call us at 800-772-8888 or give online at insight.org/donate. I'm Bill Meyer, urging you to listen when Chuck describes what to do when things go from bad to worse. Friday on Insight for Living.
The preceding message, Going from Bad to Worse, was copyrighted in 1975, 1978, 1981, 1985, 1998, and 2024, and the sound recording was copyrighted in 2024 by Charles R. Swindoll, Inc. All rights are reserved worldwide. Duplication of copyrighted material for commercial use is strictly prohibited.